This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. Yesterday was World Asthma Day and we found out more about the setting up of something called Asthma Malaysia. We also learn about the burden of the disease in Malaysia and why a non-profit like Asthma Malaysia is necessary. And I have with me Dr. Helmi Hajar Maidin, who's a consultant respiratory physician, joining us to help us understand this a lot better. Welcome to the show, Dr. Helmi. How are you today?
Thank you very much, Meera, for having me. I'm fine, thank you.
The last time we had you on was sometime last year, was it?
I think towards the end of last year.
And we spoke about e-cigarettes.
Yes.
What's happening on that front?
I think things have quietened down a bit, partly because there's still a bit of work behind the scenes with regards to determining where we are from a policy point of view, you know, whether we regulate it, and if so, to what degree we regulate it. So those conversations are ongoing, but I think as a whole, things have quietened down a bit.
Yes, it has. What do you think has brought in about the quietness as far as e-cigarettes is concerned? I'm like, at one stage it was, and you know, I understand your point in Dato' Abdul Razak when he came on as well, that we had racked up about a million new users of e-cigarettes in 2015, and then I think that was a huge concern.
It was a concern, and I think it remains a concern because there is still the perception that vaping or using e-cigarettes is something that's relatively safe. So we have had a bit of a concerted effort with regards to proving to people that it may have different effects as compared to normal cigarettes, but ultimately it's not safe. And before we can actually tell people that it's something you'd use as a harm reduction tool, more research is needed.
Okay, so that's where we stand at the moment. So let's talk about asthma today. Why do you feel so strongly about asthma? Do you think Malaysians understand asthma enough?
I don't think so. And I say that partly from anecdotal evidence, in the sense that I've seen lots of patients, I've met lots of patients who don't seem to quite understand what they're suffering from. And speaking to colleagues in the Malaysian Thoracic Society, in hospitals across Malaysia, they seem to have the same problem. So asthma, if you will allow me to just explain a little bit, in a nutshell, it's classified as a chronic inflammatory respiratory disease. And in plain English, it means that it's a long-term disease and it happens or it occurs because there's some degree of inflammation or swelling in your airways. And as a result of that, people tend to get the various symptoms that we tend to associate with asthma, classically wheezing, breathlessness, coughing. And the key thing about these symptoms are they tend to be variable. So it's not persistent throughout the day. There are certain things that make it worse. And that tends to be a pattern that we find across most patients.
Okay. And you know what? If you have a question, our phone lines are open. Just give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000. Do we know how many asthma sufferers we have at the moment?
We don't have that up-to-date studies. The last study that I looked at said it was about 7% of Malaysians. It's quite likely that it's closer to 10% now. And globally, we have about 300 million patients affected by asthma. So it's a significant number.
It is. 10% of what, 30 million? Is
of the Malaysian population.
Yes,
yeah.
That's quite a lot.
And the World Health Organization has classified it as one of the important
non-communicable disease.
That's it, thank you.
Okay. It's an NCD. But do you see the number of cases increasing over the years?
I think anecdotally, once again, yes, because we find that our clinics are getting busier, that we see more and more patients with symptoms that are in keeping with asthma. And I think with the haze as well, people have been a little bit more aware of these symptoms because it can sometimes be a little bit tricky trying to figure out if one is symptomatic because of, say, an irritation to the haze versus the haze unmasking underlying asthma. So we do find that more and more people are coming in to ask about these symptoms without perhaps realizing that they may actually be presenting with asthma.
Okay, and patients believe, I was reading that they believe their condition is under control, but symptoms suggest otherwise. Why do you think that's the case?
I think it boils down to what they understand by control. So I'll give you an example. I had a patient I met, I think slightly less than a month ago, who was going into an emergency department of our local hospital on a monthly basis to get nebulizers and steroid tablets. And for her, that was normal. She didn't think too much of it. Eventually, someone pointed out to her that long-term steroids that's used unnecessarily can lead to lots of side effects. Mm-hmm. And she came to me because she was concerned about putting on weight, which is a fair concern. But underlying all that is the fact that she had poor control of her asthma. So while it's right that asthma, in most circumstances, is a controllable condition, I think we need to be more clear with our patients with regards to what exactly good control is. And it boils down really in the simplest terms to having a normal quality of life in such a way that the asthma does not affect what you do on a day-to-day basis. It doesn't affect you sleeping at night. And it's not something that you have to reach out for your inhaler every couple of hours or so.
Okay. And do you have mild asthma cases and more severe cases?
We do.
And what determines that?
It's determined by a variety of factors. You may have, say, someone you see in clinic with stable asthma disease, and you can then classify them as mild or severe, or you can have someone coming into ED with full-blown attacks, and then you can classify them slightly differently. But it boils down to the degree of control that one has over the asthma, and perhaps to a degree, the amount of medications that's necessary. I think generally across the globe, about 10% of asthmatics are in the severe category, but they constitute the bulk of resources when it comes to treating them. So they have more medications, they have more hospitalizations, they end up using more resources generally.
Okay. We have Bunny on the line. Bunny, you have a question?
Hi. Yes, hi Mira. Hi, Doctor.
Hi.
Hi. My son is 8 years old. He was recently confirmed by a blood test that he is allergic to cats and dogs. The severity, I'm not sure, but he said he has very bad attacks when he's around mongrels specifically. We have dogs at home, Labradors, which he touches, he pets, and he's fine. But around mongrels, it escalates really badly. So my question is, number one, will this get better in time? Because what the oldies keep telling me is that keep your inhaler at bay. I mean, give it at arm's length. You don't no need to use it so often. And question number two, will this get better given time?
Sorry.
Okay, thank you very much. Do you have any more questions for Bunny?
Sorry, I didn't catch question number two.
Question number two is, people keep telling me that this will get better over time. That when he grows up, he will grow out of this.
Okay, thank you very much, Bunny. We'll answer that. Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling in for the questions, Bunny. A fair number of most children do grow out from having asthma as a child, but there isn't really any way to determine who will do so and who will continue to have problems with asthma. Usually by the time you reach puberty, you become a teenager, it tends to die off. So that's true, but then I will not be able to say specifically to that child in front of me if you are going to grow out of your asthma or not. There's no real way to test that. With regards to the inhalers, one of the reasons why we have actually thought and are pushing to establish Asthma Malaysia is because there is a lot of misconception about treatment and what constitutes appropriate treatment. When it comes to inhalers, very broadly speaking, there are two categories. You've got preventers and you've got relievers. As the name suggests, preventers are medications, primarily steroid-containing inhalers, that act to decrease inflammation and act to control your asthma. So those are inhalers that you should use regularly. That is something that you must always consult your doctor with prior to stopping, because it keeps the asthma at bay. That is not something that you should keep at arm's length. What you do need to use every so often, but not regularly, is the reliever. And those tend to be the blue inhalers, the salbutamol that you may have come across just talking to your friends or just seeing around the neighborhood. And that provides short-acting but immediate relief. So you feel better, it opens up your airways, but ultimately it does not do anything for the underlying cause, the inflammation that pushes people to have asthmatic attacks. So I would disagree with that statement whereby the oldies, to quote Bunny, say we should keep inhalers at arm's bay.
Okay. Why do you think people have this aversion towards inhalers? And Bunny isn't alone. I had the same problem mm-hmm. when my children were growing up.
Okay.
It almost feels like if you hold an inhaler or you use it, you have a disability or something. So is that a stigma or is that just very cultural? Or, you know, why do you think we have that perception?
It's partly cultural. Some of my patients have mentioned that they don't want to look weak. They don't want to look dependent. I've had patients who were concerned that they might be addicted. And when it comes to anything with the word steroid and children, you have parents who tend to be concerned about the effect on growth. So there are multiple factors, and I think it boils down to educating and explaining things clearly to the patient as to why something is necessary and why it's something that we should continue without stopping unnecessarily. So going back to your statement about inhalers being used in children and how you might perceive to be weak, we've had cases where children don't want to seem weaker mm-hmm. in school, but then if you turn around and explain that rather than appearing weaker, it's actually making you stronger, talking about how it helps those who previously may not have been able to play sports, but with inhalers or with the right therapy, they're able to actually participate normally. So putting things into context, I find, is very helpful. And also, I tend to spend some time explaining the actual cause of asthma, because I think once people understand why the inhalers are necessary with regards to the inflammation, they tend to be a bit more receptive, at least for the first few months.
And it's all in the management, isn't it, Dr. Hilmi? And if you manage it when they're children, what are the long-term benefits of that?
If you have less attacks, less exacerbations, the long-term outcome will be better in that you have better lung function, you're not going to have any long-term disabilities from your asthma. But it's also important to remember that it's not always just children who get asthma. You can have adult onsets. You have asthma in the elderly. You've got asthma as a result of occupational hazards. Some people develop asthma when they first become pregnant. So it's not just kids. We also get it as adults. And once again, going back to what I keep saying about control, knowing that you have the condition and knowing that it's been diagnosed appropriately, because we do have situations where someone wheezes and everyone automatically says he's got asthma, mm-hmm. which is not true. But having the right diagnosis will then lead to the right treatment.
Okay. When do you decide someone is actually asthmatic?
One thing about asthma is that there isn't any one specific test that can tell you you've got asthma. So it's looking at basically the pattern that emerges. It's a clinical diagnosis. Ultimately, it's the pattern in which someone presents themselves, the symptoms, and you try and correlate that with certain tests. So for example, if someone's particularly wheezy and it happens only when he or she's around cats, then you might do a allergy test to look for allergy to, say, cat fur or animal dander. But putting that always in context of the clinical presentation, because that ultimately is what tells you whether someone's got asthma or not.
Okay, so hence, there are not many people like you around to diagnose. How many respiratory physicians do we have in the country?
I don't know the exact number, but the last time we had a chat about this around the coffee table, it was about 80.
80. Throughout the whole country.
Throughout the whole country. Mm-hmm. I would argue,
and that's 10% are asthmatic, which is about 30 million people.
Yes.
And 80 of you to serve 30 million people.
Yeah. My maths isn't that good enough to give you a ratio, but it sounds small. So I should plug to whoever's thinking of doing medicine to become a respiratory physician, because it's all fun. But I think also what we forget is most asthmatics are stable, and most asthmatics can be diagnosed and managed at primary care level. So alongside supporting and putting in more resources for respiratory medicine as a whole, I think we should do the same in terms of resources, education for primary care physicians. So your general practitioner, most asthma cases should be managed at a primary care level, I feel. And if we do have situations where there are, say, doctors who are not comfortable or are not sure, then there should be a program in place where they can easily access doctors or specialists who can then provide guidance.
Do you think a lot of asthma cases are being misdiagnosed or not even being diagnosed as asthma?
I think we suffer from both. We have cases that are not asthma, that patients are being given inappropriate treatment, and I have a particular dislike for oral steroids that are being given unnecessarily. Similarly, we have patients who have been told that it's just bronchitis, it'll go away, but then 2 years later, they still have the same symptoms, and then you have to tell them that, you know, you've got asthma. And sometimes patients just react in shock. You know, I've had this for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Why are you telling me I've got asthma? Oh, I'm 25. It cannot possibly be asthma. So if you've got patients who've had symptoms throughout their life and then only just get told at a certain stage that actually this is something that you could have avoided, you know, way back when.
Mm-hmm. So our perception of asthma itself is not the best in that cultural, again, I'm 25, I cannot be asthmatic. It's a sign of weakness.
I think it's quite funny because you have, I would say pretty much everyone has heard of asthma or perhaps knows someone with asthma.
Yep.
But actually understanding the disease and knowing what to do about it and the right treatment for it, that information is lacking. And for me, at the end of the day, any patient that I have, or, well, my approach to medicine, I think what most of us should do is to treat diseases as a partnership. So when you're going through a particular management plan with the patient, it's important that the patient understands things and is participating in the decision of what medicine to take when, because only then will you get better understanding. And when you have a patient who knows things, the patient will be empowered. That patient will know what questions to ask, will know what websites in Google to trust, because, you know, you can get all sorts of nonsense and, you know, but at the same time, lots of information. So guiding them is going to help matters. And ultimately, if we do it with the patients initially and perhaps with juniors or, you know, medical professionals who are not as experienced, then ultimately we can change that landscape.
Okay, good news on that front,
I suppose.
When we come back, I'll find out more about alternative complementary medicine as well as compliance. I think compliance is crucial when it comes to the management of asthma. How do we manage all of that? We'll find out. Our phone lines are open. If you have a question on asthma, Dr. Helmi Hajamaidin in the studio with me, consultant respiratory physician. It was World Asthma Day yesterday. We'll come back and find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasuthi. We are discussing asthma today. Yesterday was World Asthma Day, and we're opening up the lines for your questions. Give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-000. You can ask Dr. Helmi Hajamaidin, consultant respiratory physician, anything you want to know about asthma. He's the expert, man. 80 of them only in the country, and serving 30 million asthmatics.
Yes.
Yeah, I've done the ratio. It's 1 to 700, by the way. Approximately there. But as you said, it can be managed at a primary care level, mm-hmm. meaning GPs and all of them can actually help you. But do we know the national burden of the disease?
The prevalence, I think, is reaching approximately 10%. And what we do know is the patients with asthma tend to have increased rates of absenteeism from work, from school. In terms of actual numbers that the health ministry is having to spend on asthmatic patients, I don't have the figures for that. I don't think we do have up-to-date figures for that. But we do know, for example, that at least 50% of patients with asthma have had to seek emergency help from either their GPs or from emergency departments in the past or in the preceding 12 months. So that on its own gives you an idea of how it affects people's lives. So you have got the cost, not just to the individual, but to family, to parents having to take time off work, to actually take their children away from school, to the right doctor. You've got costs in terms of medications and hospitalization. And studies consistently show that the cost of poor treatment is far higher than the cost of treating patients once they've actually had an attack.
Okay, and do we understand, do Malaysians understand the extent of how this is a huge public health issue?
I would argue not. I don't think asthma is as up there as, you know, perhaps more sexy topics like cancer and cardiovascular disease, because I don't think the focus is there as much. It's also something that I think a lot of people feel is benign. You know, you've got asthma, so what? You cough a bit, you wheeze a bit, and then you get better. Or you might need inhalers and medications for a little while. But unfortunately, people do die from asthma. And perhaps it's not just about the mortality, but the morbidity. So all those things I explained or mentioned with regards to losing time off work, having poor quality of life, not sleeping well, all those things have an effect on the individual. One interesting study that was conducted in the UK looked at the deaths from asthma over a period of 1 year. And what it found was like approximately 50% of it was preventable. So 50% of asthma deaths in the UK, which one would think, in fact, is actually the provider of the gold standard with regards to international guidelines. Even there, half of those who died from asthma died because they were not on appropriate medication.
Mm, okay. Then it's a problem worldwide, really.
It is. How each country addresses the issue really boils down to the socio-economic situation as well. And I suppose one has to prioritize. So if you are in a less developed economy, you're more likely to be troubled by infectious disease and you have to put your resources into vaccinations, antibiotics, things like that. Whereas if you're in a more developed society, then you can arguably afford to then focus on the NCDs, because then you have different priorities and you can then justify spending more money on other conditions.
Inhalers are not cheap.
They're not.
They're costly.
They are costly, and to a degree it depends on the type of inhalers as well. You have something called the WHO, I can't remember the actual term, but basically they have got a list of essential medications. In fact, the list is probably called the essential medications list. And things like salbutamol, fluticasone, which is a type of inhaled steroid, and budesonide are on it. So it's meant to be subsidized by governments. Once again, on the basis that overall, for governments throughout the world, if you have asthma that's poorly controlled, it's ultimately going to cost you more than the amount of money you have to put in from the hospitalizations and the emergency medications that you have to use.
So subsidies, subsidizing it is a lot cheaper in the long run. Compliance, do you find it's a problem amongst asthma sufferers?
Definitely. I would say that once again it boils down to one's understanding about the role of the inhalers as well as the stigma attached to it. But once they understand why they need it, and I think sometimes once they feel the effects of not using it, then people tend to be more compliant.
Okay. And then when they become complacent again, then, you know, it just goes on and on.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like smoking, you know.
Yeah. Smoking, speaking of that, how does that contribute? Can that trigger asthma?
It can. So one aspect of asthma is you have hypersensitivity and hyperreactivity. So you have a situation where your tubes, the tubes in your lungs, react more to toxins, noxious stimuli around you, of which tobacco smoke is one of the most common and one of the things that actually affect people the most.
Okay. Severe asthma sufferers, what's their life like?
The severe asthmatic tends to be someone who has got a really difficult life in the sense that quality of life is poor. Social circumstances may change, so you tend to be someone who is unable to socialize as much, you can't go out as much, you may not be able to even drive yourself around. Unfortunately, it tends to be more, I would say, more prevalent in those in the lower socioeconomic strata. The reason for that, I think, is multifactorial, but it will include things like tobacco smoking and things like access to healthcare. And I'm talking about this globally rather than specifically in KL or in Malaysia. And because they don't have as much access, and because, as you say, in some circumstances they are unable to afford the right treatment, partly because there's no access or because they don't actually have the insight as to the need for these medication, they tend to go into a vicious cycle. And then you go into a vicious cycle, you end up taking more and more oral steroids, you then end up putting on weight, which then makes you feel more breathless. If you have really bad long-term asthma, you have a situation where, if you imagine, you take a deep breath in and you hold your breath, and then you try to take a deep breath again after that. That's how you feel when you've got really bad asthma. Your lungs are almost persistently full and tight, and taking the extra breath makes it really, really difficult. So it's not very pleasant, I'm afraid.
Do we have many severe asthma sufferers?
I don't know of the exact numbers in Malaysia. Once again, generally across the board, it's about 10%. But when I used to run the severe asthma clinic when I was in the UK, the first thing we did was to actually reconfirm the diagnosis. So people who may be labelled as having severe asthma, they don't always have that. So we have, like I mentioned before, an issue with not just overdiagnosis, but also underdiagnosis. So if you misdiagnose someone, you can keep throwing steroids at them for months on end and they'll never improve, and all you do is actually make their life worse.
So what you're saying is it can mimic other conditions?
Yes. So if you have, for example, if you have cardiac failure, you can present with a wheeze, and you can clinically look quite similar to someone who's having an asthma attack. You're wheezing, you're breathless, you're a smoker, you're a bit overweight, and there's nothing much on the x-ray that may perhaps lead you in one way or the other. So in some circumstances, you actually end up treating both. And then you find out as the patient stabilizes which one is the more likely candidate, and then you treat them accordingly. So there are mimics out there, and it's quite important not to jump into conclusions and always be wary that there may be other differential diagnoses that we need to think about.
What about the hygiene hypothesis, where there's more, you know, how we've become so clean and, you know, we don't want to be... we don't want to be in contact with dust and, you know, the works, right? But that's now coming and biting us in the back because we've become too clean. Is that working the way it is?
It's an interesting theory, because the theory basically says that if you get exposed to germs early enough, your immune system learns, I'm doing air quotes here, learns how to respond appropriately, because the theory is you may have inappropriate response to allergens. But it's a theory that's based on, I suppose, epidemiological data as opposed to real hard scientific evidence. So it's more a correlation rather than a causative thing. And it's quite difficult to say, you know, take your child out, let him get dirty without really knowing which germs are doing what. Because on the flip side, if your child gets RSV, for example, a recurrent viral infection, then you're more likely to get asthma and you're more likely to develop asthma in the long run. So it's very difficult to say that this is actually something that's going to help us determine the appropriate management.
Okay, so if you feel you are a little OCD, then you maybe want to keep yourself in check, perhaps?
Yeah, speaking as someone who is a little bit OCD.
Let's talk about the power of hand washing. Sometimes we overdo it, but it's as simple as that, isn't it? Just wash your hands.
I think we just need to be sensible. I don't think that things like wiping every single surface with antibacterial solution is actually going to be of any use, and arguably it's going to be harmful. But hand washing, yes, because it boils down to the ability to transmit something from one person to another. And, you know, you go out to the LRT, everyone's sneezing around you. You want to make sure that you're not bringing anything back home. So you just wash your hands, make sure that things are clean.
And what sorts of things do you think we need to invest in right now to ensure better management of asthma in Malaysia?
I would say that a couple of things that are important would be, one, to have a database of patients so that we know who is being affected, what are the hindrances or the barriers to getting appropriate treatment, and if we can look into things like whether it's socioeconomic, whether it's geographical, whether it's cultural, then that will help us as a nation to determine the right policy to address these issues. So one would be a database, and I think alongside that, and I know it's happening, but I think we can do more, would be education. So education for medical staff, not just doctors, but nurses as well. And ultimately, we need to make sure that we have a more informed patient population as well.
Inhaler technology, has that evolved over the years?
It has. We've gone from, well, once upon a time, cigarettes were used as treatments for asthma.
Really?
Yes, believe it or
what
not.
What were we thinking?
We weren't. but it just goes to show, you know, once upon a time, cigarettes were like good for your lungs. It helps you cough.
Yes.
It did. Helps you expectorate. It did. Mm-hmm. But also caused cancer. But that's a different issue. The technology has improved from just having, say, nebulizers where things are being thrown up and you basically take it in, to having very specialized devices that are easy to use, that you might not have to use as frequently as before, to the actual contents as well. So some of the inhalers, for example, have particles that are of the appropriate size for your airways, because you could have too big size particles or too small. But you want to make sure that the medication go to the right parts of your lungs so that you're treated appropriately. So it's an evolving field of technology. And ultimately, it's all about making sure that the right inhaler is used easily by the right patients.
What's the difference between a nebulizer and the inhalers?
A nebulizer is a machine that basically vaporizes a type of medicine that you put in the nebulizer. So say you use salbutamol, for example, you can put in a salbutamol solution, it vaporizes it, you have a mask through which the solution goes through, the vapor goes through, and then you just inhale it. So you're inhaling something without any sort of extra force or any extra assistance. Mm-hmm. With an inhaler, it's the thing that you see being carried around, and you may have a pressurized device, or you may have a device where you take a deep breath in and then medicine just goes straight into your lungs.
What factors do you think we should consider when we start educating people about asthma?
We should start by not assuming anything, because I would just start by assuming that I just contradicted myself. I would say, okay, we'll start at the very beginning. Yeah. So what I mean by that is, don't assume people know what asthma is. Mm-hmm. Even though they'll say, my cousin's got asthma, I know all about it. But actually, if you dig deeper, there may be lots of misconceptions. So I think the first thing is to address those misconceptions, make data as easily available in a way that's very easy for people to understand. Because doctors, and I know from experience, we talk in jargon, and we can sometimes be a little bit paternalistic. Understatement.
I was about to say, but that's all right.
And
we're getting better.
I think we are. Yeah. We are getting better. And I think it's also because, once again, it's a two-way communication. Patients are becoming more aware of their rights. They are becoming more aware of what to ask. And sometimes, because of Google, they come and ask you perhaps the wrong questions. But then it's an opportunity to actually address those misconceptions. It's an opportunity to dig deeper and to, once again, not just build understanding of the disease, but ultimately you're building that relationship. Because it is a partnership. It's not, we've gone from the days when we are paternalistic or condescending and, you know, do as you're told. Mm-hmm. We need to grow together, I think, as a whole.
Okay. And can we motivate people or asthmatics to take their medications better? How can the person who's the non-asthmatic play mm-hmm. a role in caring and, you know, helping the asthmatic?
It would be very much in context. So in terms of, say, if you're looking after someone, then if you are a child looking after an elderly parent, for example, then you would be the one who needs to help remind that parent about the inhalers, why it's important. You might need to address the issue of the inhaler not working particularly well for your parents.
Expiry dates,
mm-hmm. where it's being kept. Arguably, if you're reaching your expiry date, then you haven't been using your inhalers properly. So those are the things that you need to look at. So if you're visiting an elderly parent, you can look into those things. You can help with regards to trigger factors. So if you're a smoker, then you shouldn't really be smoking around anyone, but particularly asthmatics, because you can actually trigger an attack. If you are someone who actually has asthma, and you, in terms of motivation, then it boils down to understanding what you gain, what benefits you have as a person, as an individual, by sticking to the regime. Because if you are someone who wants stable quality of life, which most of us do, if you're someone who wants to be able to go out and do more physical activity, then having an appreciation of why you're on certain medications would go a long way to motivating you to actually use those things.
So you can exercise if you're an asthmatic?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, ultimately, the aim is to have a normal quality of life as per any other individual. While we're on the topic of exercise, we have a branch of asthma that is exercise-induced. So some people do have asthmatic symptoms that only occur when they're exercising, particularly if you do things like swimming or cycling. And there is treatment for it. It is ultimately controllable. And once again, you should be able to go back to a point in time or a point where you're able to do those physical activities without any limitations.
So now you're setting up, together with Dr. Sundri, something called Asthma Malaysia.
So
it's a not-for-profit.
It's a non-profit. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the aim is to address, I think, many of the issues we've spoken about this evening. Education, patient empowerment, and we have very good support from the Malaysian Thoracic Society and Lung Foundation of Malaysia, because we feel that we need to have an advocacy group, a platform to raise the awareness regarding asthma. Ultimately, these things should be run by patients, I feel. Patients should take it upon themselves to address deficiencies in policy, deficiencies in management. But as a start, we need someone, I think, to be the voice of this minority out there who's not making their voice heard.
And how will you support patients? Besides just education and, you know, are you going to provide counselling, that sort of thing?
I think initially it'll be education. And while we're doing the initial base work, what we'll need to do is we'll need to figure out what exactly patients want as well. Because it's good for me as a doctor to say, oh, they don't know X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. But actually, from a patient's perspective, it might be something completely different. So what we intend to do is we need to do like a survey to actually find out where the deficiencies are, what are patients' expectations, followed on by education, as you pointed out. But ultimately, we hope to be able to provide support in terms of knowing where to go for the right treatment, knowing things like the patient management plan, which is one way of planning for when you have a bad asthmatic attack, knowing where you can get the right medication from and why you're getting the right medication. And ultimately, if we are able to get to the point where we hope to be, even doing things like research and lobbying for the appropriate policy to be put in place.
What spurred Dr. Sundari and yourself on to want to set this up? I mean, you've got a full-time job. This is an extension, I suppose, but it will be very time-consuming as well.
It will be. I'm very fortunate because Dr. Sundari is someone who has a very similar mindset to myself, and she's very passionate about her patients. She and I have felt that because we have come across so many patients who do not seem to appreciate the gravity of the situation, we felt that we need to do something beyond just that one individual who is sat in front of you. This is one way for us to hopefully affect change at a greater level. Mm-hmm. We can't possibly, as you mentioned earlier on, the ratio of respiratory specialists to patients is minuscule. So one way is to utilize social media, utilize technology, get people to come through us, perhaps not in person, but through the virtual space. So those are things that I think we are hoping to achieve. And yes, it takes time, but ultimately, if we can make a difference, then, you know,
why not?
Why not?
Mm-hmm. And how do we get in touch with you?
At the moment, it's through Facebook. Mm-hmm. I've got an Asthma Malaysia page. And in the background, we're working on a web page, which we hope to be up and running in the next 2 to 3 months.
Okay, and this is going to be launched?
You don't have an actual date yet.
Okay.
Yes.
Right, okay.
Facebook for now.
All right. Would you have a message? It was World Asthma Day yesterday. Mm-hmm. Would you have a message?
I would say that the main message is you are able to control asthma. So if you have asthma, yes, it's not curable, but with the right treatment, you'll be able to control it. And one must not stop treatment unnecessarily without consulting a doctor first.
Do you think a cure is in sight?
No.
Okay, unfortunately. All right then, not for the moment.
Not for the moment.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us today. Dr. Helmi Hajimaidin, consultant respiratory physician, speaking to us about asthma on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.